Hello, my name is Rich Jones. I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and the Chief Clinical Officer of U-Turn Health, and I'm also a co-host of this wonderful podcast.
And my name is Liz, and I'm a co-founder of U-Turn and a co-host of You Learn, You Turn.
And let's get the show on the road.
Welcome, everybody, to You Learn, You Turn. This week, we have a wonderful guest. His name is Gary Cooper. And I found out through LinkedIn that we have a lot in common, a lot of family friends that are the same. And we both grew up, I grew up going to Pawleys Island in the summer, and he lives there full time. And he has a great story of recovery, resilience, and just overcoming a lot. And he wrote a book called The Success Paradox, How to Surrender and Win. And with no further ado, please help me welcome Gary Cooper to the show. Welcome, Gary.
Hey, thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to be here.
Well, we are glad you could join us today. And I want to go back as far as you want to go back, but really to you were living a life. You looked like you had it all. You had all the bells and whistles. You had a healthy family. You had all the money in the world. Tell us what instigated, and I do want to talk about the Open Mind Fitness Foundation. And without giving any spoilers, just start at the beginning and tell us how the genesis of this foundation and how you instigated a huge life change.
Well, first of all, again, thank you for letting me be here. I just start way even before the beginning. You know, I grew up in Andrews, South Carolina, and I had a great childhood. I mean, an amazing childhood. I grew up in Andrews, and it really was an idyllic childhood. Over there in Andrews, we would hunt, we would fish. I got to play, you know, two sports. You know, I was the quarterback. I was the point guard on the basketball team. We went to church. We would go all the way to Clemson and back on Saturdays. And that's a long drive. Mm-hmm. We'd be at church on Sunday mornings. And then we would live 4 months out of the year at the beach. And then nice. I'd get to hang out with all the Greenville and Columbia kids. And I think that was the first seed of, you know, I was different, you know, because I would see all these kids that I thought were better than me. They had more because, you know, I was growing up in a blue collar country town. And then I would see these kids from the big city. I'm doing quotations. Uh-huh. And, you know, they were from the big city and they drove different cars and they wore different clothes. And I all of a sudden started aspiring to be more like them. But then I would have to go back to the country. And I wasn't necessarily jealous. It gave me something to shoot for. So I started living these two lives. Like, I would go back to Andrews and I would kind of be like too much for Andrews and not enough for the beach. And I kind of grew up that way. And so I graduated with terrible grades. All I cared about was sports, partying, and girls, you know, growing up. So I did that and barely got out of high school with grades. And then I ended up going to Spartanburg Methodist for a year, went to Walford. And the day I stepped on the campus at Walford, I knew I was less than. I would always shoot for the stars. So coming from Andrews, going to Walford, that was shooting for the stars, you know. Yeah. So when I went there, once I stepped on campus, I was like, oh, I might have overshot, you know. I was 13 hours behind. I had to catch up just to get into college.
Okay.
I mean, it was that bad. And kids already had 18 hours ahead. So, you know, I was, you know, 30 hours behind people. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of catching up. So I had to treat college like a job. So I had a great work ethic, and that was kind of the story of my life. I wanted more, and I was willing to work for it. And so that's kind of the story that led all the way up to my troubles. You know, I ended up going to Wofford, graduated with decent grades after a couple of, you know, rough patches, went to graduate school and graduated with great grades from there, and came home and started the business with my dad. I grew up in nursing homes. Actually, that one of them he leased from the Miller family, your friends, for 37 years.
Wow.
And he ended up owning 12, and he delivered drugs to 14,000 patients in North and South Carolina. You know, this guy built a golf course, hotels. I mean, there wasn't anything that he started a bank, Plantation Federal. There wasn't much that this guy didn't do.
It doesn't sound like it. Wow.
But he wore khaki pants and, you know, a white, you know, button down shirt. He was a very, very humble, humble man. And I think that's the beginning of starting to compare myself to other people. You know, I think in my, I now look back at it, I started thinking I had to beat him. You know, I was under his shadow, and maybe not beat him, but keep up with him.
Right.
You know, and I was seeking his approval. I was the youngest of four kids. And I think I always not wanted, but needed it, needed his approval. And he didn't withhold it. I mean, he was a very caring, very nurturing father.
Yeah.
And so was my mother. I can't blame any of my troubles on my parents. I started working. So I think work was my first addiction. I was a young 24, 25 year old, and my dad helped me start this business. It was his business, and work became my addiction. I was getting pats on the back. I was getting all these accolades, and I was getting all this responsibility. And I would work hard, and I would come home and drink. But I was at work the next morning on time. Like, that's what I learned from my granddad. That's what I learned from my dad. My dad wasn't a big drinker, but that's how I got through college. And we built a business from nothing to $25 million in like 3 years.
That's amazing. Golly.
My goal was to keep people out of nursing homes.
Mm.
So, and my dad, I thought that he would be upset with me because he had dedicated his life to the elderly. And so I dedicated my life to the elderly in a different way. And he loved it. And he loved whatever his kids wanted to do. One was a school teacher, and he was probably more proud of her than anybody. He was such a, again, great guy. But he had this big shadow. You know, he had been so successful. So I distorted that in my own head that I had to be more successful than him. So I was working and fueling it with alcohol. And then lo and behold, my dad dies.
How old were you?
I was 28.
Mm.
And it kind of, you know, I didn't have a choice. I had to either rise to the occasion or run.
Yeah.
And so, this is in the book. I had $8 million of debt. His other companies and things that I didn't really know what to do or what all he did with them, all that responsibility came on. And in a weird way, I now know probably ego and all that stuff. It gave me a chance to be the big shot.
Mm.
I didn't think of it like that at the time. I thought of it as, I have to do this to take care of my mother.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. But the amount of pressure on a 28-year-old kid, a month later, 9/11 happened.
Jeez.
And then Bank of America called all of our loans due. I didn't have a choice. I just had to put on my shoes and go to work. And I did. And I went from beer to vodka.
That's a slippery slope there. So total change in how fast it hits your system, right?
Because it was the low carb phase.
Oh.
And I went to vodka and Crystal Light, you know, with no calories in it.
Yeah, I did that for a while.
And man, I remember a euphoric feeling when I started drinking that. And it was like, oh my God, I could stay up for hours.
Wow.
And I remember being in hotel rooms, going to meet with all these fancy lawyers in Atlanta and Charleston and Charlotte, and then having to bring, the week after my dad died, my competitors were at MUSC telling them they should kick us out because the old man was dead and the kid didn't know what he was doing. I mean, it was that kind of stuff.
So what did you do?
I would stay up in my, I remember being in my hotel room and I would have these amazing speeches, or we had to redo our legal structure. And I didn't know anything about legal stuff, but I would design these new LLCs and all this stuff to reform our legal structure. And I would go in Austin Bird Law Firm and they would be like, who did this for you? And I'd be like, I did. They're like, damn, that's actually pretty good.
Wow.
And so I was like, man, this alcohol thing works. I'm a genius.
Makes you Superman.
I'm a genius.
Yeah.
Fast forward 12 years later, I would wake up and I couldn't even understand what I'd read. Yeah. I remember watching a documentary on, it wasn't Neil Diamond, Bob Dylan.
Okay.
And he said he remembered doing the same thing. He remembers writing, you know, he's our poet.
Yeah.
And he said he remembers like the night that the switch went off and he would wake up and he couldn't read what he had written.
Oh, man. It definitely messes with your brain. So you say it's over kind of a 12-year period that you started the decline into alcoholism. Didn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. You're still able to go to work, still able to function, still able to have a family, have a marriage. That's a long progression. So what happened when things started to get bad? What did that look like for you?
So I was driving 60,000 miles a year building my business. And I'd always carry my running shoes with me, literally. And I would run 50 to 60 miles a week.
Yeah, gum.
And what happened is my dad had 6 back surgeries before he passed away. And my brothers had 6. And my sister's getting her hips replaced now. And I came home one day. I was having lots of back issues. And I came home one day from running the bridge in Charleston, and I stopped in McClellanville and I got a couple of beers. And by the time I got to Pawleys Island, I couldn't get out of my car. And finally enough was enough. And I went to see a doctor and they were like, at some point in time, you had broken L4 and L5 in your back. Because in the low country, we live pretty hard when we're young. We had wrecked some cars, played football and did a bunch of crazy stuff. And they said, you have to get surgery if you really want it to be better. And I have been trying to outrun surgery my whole life, literally outrun it. And when I heard I had to get surgery, I think depression set in. I can now say that. I don't think I knew it then.
Yeah.
So I had the back surgery, and I think even before the surgery, that's when I know I crossed that invisible line. My behavior, my actions are all so despicable. I don't even recognize that guy today.
Yeah. What year was that, Gary?
Probably 2015.
Okay.
And then several months after the surgery, that's when I would wake up and people would say, "You emailed me last night. You can't remember what you said."
Yeah.
And some people I did not get forgiveness from. Some people I did. These were business partners, family members, some people I didn't even know. Then I went back to the doctor and said, "This back surgery didn't work." And he said, "Long story short, no wonder, because you have to get both your hips replaced."
Oh my God.
And I was 44, 45. And the depression got 10 times worse. And there's a scripture in Matthew that says, when the eye is dark, the whole body becomes sick, because your eye is the light of the world. And I remember having every room that I went into dark. And my whole body was sick. Not only was my bone problem bad, my digestive system was horrible. My mental state was, I was barely human. I had no compassion for other people. I remember my wife telling me that one of our longtime family friends died, and I had zero feelings about it. There was like no compassion, no empathy, no anything for other people. And I remember waking up and not wanting to be alive and wondering how I still was alive. In places that I didn't know how I got there. I couldn't sleep without the aid of alcohol. And I would always have about that much vodka laying beside my bed.
Yeah.
And I would wake up and I would drink that just to go back to sleep.
Just for our listeners, it's like a cup full, like a shot glass. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I would get in the shower and I would feel like I was having a heart attack.
Yeah.
Just to take a shower. And then I'd have to drink more vodka just to get over to shower. And then I would go get two Mike's Hard Lemonades. And I would drink those just to get through to lunch.
Yeah.
And I would set up meetings for lunch with people that I could have wine with.
Mm-hmm.
And that would get me to happy hour, which got closer and closer.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the whole time, I knew I was this charlatan. I had zero self-esteem. I knew people knew I was a liar. I knew I was a liar, which made me want to drink even more.
Yeah.
And, I knew the time was coming to an end, but I wanted it to end, but I couldn't stop it. And it's like this merry-go-round that you can't stop, and you want it to stop, but you don't want it to stop at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and the lies and the drinking and the vicious nature of it is like a cancer that just continues to breed. And the weird part is I didn't care about hurting myself. In fact, I think I found pleasure in hurting myself. But what made it stop for me is I finally hurt enough people that I love.
Yeah.
And I am very grateful that I met people after I got sober that taught me that I could forgive myself. Because otherwise, I don't think I could have ever gotten sober.
Yeah.
Because alcohol took over my life. Mm-hmm. What started out as fun, those fun times hearing my granddad and everybody laughing and frying fish and cooking crabs and fun times in high school and college and concerts and all those things. That alcohol was like our book calls it the rapacious creditor. And I think of it like that too. I think of it as almost like a drug dealer, you know, for me. And I didn't know what that word means. I think of it as like a drug dealer.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning, the drug dealer is fun, or I think of it as a pretty girl. You know, in the beginning, it's kind of like enticing, mm-hmm. you know, coming and inviting. And alcohol was that for a long time. But then it's like it's loaned me so much fun. I still think it's fun. And I have to remember the really bad times. And so that's kind of a long-winded version of how I got from fun to the rapacious creditor.
We're going to end right here and pick up next week. So tune in to find out how Gary turns his life around and ends up creating a guide for living.